which is Mir Fasihi versus Fleet Mortgage, Mr. Zavez.
My retirees disappear. Oh, most of them are young. We got them all down. Well, they're staying in the room, so.
Oh, that's fine. Maybe these are. Mr. Zavis, where are you?
I think they're fans of you. Go ahead.
May it please the court. I'm Attorney John Zavis. I'm accompanied here today by Attorney James Shedden. Represent Angela Perry and Michael Green, who are objecting to the second settlement in this case. As the court may remember, settlement came up on appeal approximately a year and a half ago, and this court rejected that settlement. I guess the good news from our perspective as objectors is that this settlement's even worse than the last one.
Well, how could it be worse?
I'll go through that, Your Honor, if you'd like to hear it.
Well, let me just try to get to the one of the bottom lines on it. The information that FMC provided was all publicly available information, right? The information that it was provided to the telemarketing firms, that information was public information. It was already in the public domain.
Some of it was in the public domain, Your Honor. It's not clear that all of it was in the public domain.
And what wasn't?
Again, under the state law that our case started out in Massachusetts, one of the violations that a party like Fleet can commit is it's not adequate to simply say all this information was in the public domain if it's scattered throughout the public domain. If Fleet has amassed, with the help of the class, has amassed this information into kind of an easy to digest and easy to use block of data, then the selling of that data is a different. You can't simply defend against that by saying, well, you know, if we had gone down to the deeds office, we could have dug up a piece of paper that would have shown this. Because for 1.4 million people, I mean, you can't do it. It's not cost effective.
I understand the packaging argument. I just want to find out if that information, albeit being in a lot of different places, it was still publicly available information.
Well, I can't fully answer that because our belief is that it's not correct, because part of what we believe that Fleet conveyed to the telemarketing firms was the fact that these people were creditworthy in the sense that they were keeping current on their mortgage payments. Now, I'm not aware if there's any easy or simple way to obtain that information, and that raises the issues of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, because part of the plaintiff's claim in this case is that, you know, what they're basically providing is a credit report. Because again, telemarketing firms, they can buy their own phone books and they can page through them themselves. Part of what they got from Fleet was, here is a block of people who meet certain characteristics which they possibly could have determined from public records if they had expended all that effort, but who are also paying their bills. And obviously that's something of value if you're going to sell people, particularly the type of products that they were selling here, which were these services that were billed at, say, $10 a month or $15 a month. You don't want to go through the aggravation of selling it to someone unless you feel like they're the kind of person that pays the bills on a monthly basis. So again, that's an important piece of information, and in fact, a piece of information which I think is pretty clear from the intent of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that Congress was particularly concerned about protecting from what happened here, this kind of just. And I don't want to say give it away, which is the word Fleet will use, or share. I mean, this information was sold. This was a commercial transaction using what we hope to be our class members' personal information.
What is the status of the Massachusetts case, the Lassman case? Because I know it was pending the last time we had this case. Is it still?
Your Honor, we voluntarily dismissed that pursuant to a tolling agreement because we could not get the Massachusetts court system.
Oh, so it's dead?
It's not. Well, it can be revived, though.
What do you mean can be revived?
We dismissed it voluntarily But Fleet agreed to toll any statute of limitations.
Oh, I see.
And the problem was that the Massachusetts court system has their own internal clock, and it was hard for us to keep running back and forth between the two cases and saying, well, can you wait until something's decided in Illinois, and et cetera, et cetera. So we finally ran into a judge who said, we've waited long enough, and we're either...
So in other words, that case is awaiting... So presumably, if your appeal prevailed and there was a new agreement or something, you might get in this litigation the relief that you would have been seeking in Massachusetts. Is that the idea?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you'd never have to go back to Massachusetts.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the idea.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, if an equitable nationwide settlement could be worked out,
right,
then we would hope that our Massachusetts people would be part of that.
Let me just ask you. I was unclear what this status of the attorney's fees were, whether that was anything before. So the district judge said $750,000 did she actually award that, or is that a ceiling or something, or what exactly is that?
My understanding is that it's been awarded, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Been awarded part of the $750,000?
It was part of the settlement agreement, and she approved it in its entirety.
Do we know how it's been divided among the lawyers?
No, Your Honor, we have not had a chance to pursue that, although, as we point out in our papers, these two separate groups of plaintiff's attorneys who purport to represent the two different classes in order to protect the sometimes conflicting interests of the two classes are all apparently being paid in some non-disclosed way out of that same pot of money.
Well, what I was curious about is that the lawyers that had represented the class in our previous round, and whom we had criticized, didn't they all shift over to the information sharing class, and then a new lawyer comes in to represent the telemarketing? Is that what happened?
I think what they purported to do was to shift some portion of the pre-existing lawyers to the telemarketing class.
Well, they shifted it the other way.
And then
way.
The information sharing class, which were the people that the court was especially critical, because they're the people
that got nothing,
but now they have a new attorney who got them nothing.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
So, Your Honor, just to talk briefly through the points.
I just want to ask one other question about this $300,000 that's in litigation expenses in California. Is that any benefit to any of the class members here?
Your Honor, what happened when these cases were brought, they were brought for the most part in state court.
Mm-hmm.
A small firm, California, Milberg Weiss, brought a case on behalf of the California plaintiffs. And because they were moving under a California statute, I guess they limited their class to California residents. Anyways, as part of the rolling up of this case, the rolling up of these cases in general, Fleet made a separate deal with Milberg Weiss and their plaintiffs to settle California action. The case that these people are purporting to settle today does not include anybody in that group. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, $300,000 plus of what is purported to be our settlement is used to pay Milberg Weiss, so attorney's fees and expenses. So, I mean, if you want to just to start unraveling kind of the conceptual nightmare here, our people got nothing from that. Our people are not part of that.
Right.
But we've paid Milberg Weiss's attorney's fees. Are Milberg Weiss, are they our attorneys too in some sense?
That's why I wanted you to address that. It was kind of eluding me as to why that $300,000 was being paid to them, and I wanted your view on that.
We cannot think of a good reason why, and perhaps my brothers can.
I mean, you're saying, in fact, Fleet had a separate debt to a separate group of people.
Right, Your Honor. And in the record,
settlement is paying this unrelated debt.
Right, Your Honor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in other words, again, a simple concept, money's fungible. Fleet just took money and used it for something else, but they want to still credit it to our class.
And is that what the district judge did? Did she treat that as part of... I mean, she could just have said, well, you say $2.4 million, it's really $2.1 million.
Well, the district judge said, talked about some of the danger signs that the Seventh Circuit talked about with the first settlement. And one of the things they said was, we're kind of troubled with this notion of reversion. Now, The district judge accepted their argument that there was no reversion, which we think is incorrect. In fact, arguably, this is maybe something worse than a reversion, because if you remember from your first opinion, you said reversions can be okay in the right context, because what you're doing is you're encouraging the defendant to put up a little more money, because if it turns out that they don't, the claims don't max out the pot, they'll get the money back. But that's not what's occurring here. This is money that'll never go to this class. I mean, it was spent years ago. It's just, for whatever reason, and I can't think of a good one, it's being added into the value of this settlement.
Now, will you get attorney's fees? Did you get attorney? So the first time, were you the lawyer for the objectors the last round? I've forgotten.
We have been the lawyers for the objectors from the get-go,
okay.
Your Honor.
So when you knocked out that settlement and got us to reverse, so do you get an award of attorney's fees for? Did you get an award of attorney's fees for that?
We asked the district court for one, and there's a little bit of jurisdictional confusion because it's not clear. We wanted to protect our right because our theory is we're the only people that have conveyed. And if there is a benefit here, we're the only ones that have done it, and we're the but-for cause of it, so we should get the entire attorney fee awarded here. She has not, Judge Lefko has not acted on that.
I see. So you have a pending request for attorney's fees.
But we're also up here, Your Honor, because Our primary argument is this settlement is not adequate.
But
we're trying to cover both bases because we don't want to waive that because we may come back again if she decides no, the people that quote unquote sold the class down the river are entitled to the attorney's fees.
No, I understand. So suppose we upheld the settlement, you would still have a strong argument for if we upheld the settlement and said this is really an improvement and and you would have played an important role in getting the improved settlement, so you'd be entitled to attorney's fees. So my question is, would those attorney's fees come out of the $750,000, or would they be an additional charge to Fleet? I'm just curious how this works in these objector cases.
Your Honor, that would probably be something we'd have to sit down and try to iron out with the other parties. I mean, again, we don't think that the existing counsel are entitled to anything. But
I understand.
But there'd be a negotiation, and ultimately, I guess we'd have to go back in front of Judge Lefko and let her try to hash it out.
Okay. Well, do you want to save your rest of your time?
Yes, sir.
So thank you, Mr. Zavis. Mr. Cantor?
May it please the court, I'm Cliff Cantor, appointed class counsel for the telemarketing class by Judge Lefko. There was a little bit of a mix-up just now. The previous counsel for the information sharing, the previous counsel in the case shifted to the information sharing class.
Yes, that was my impression.
Yes, you were correct, Your Honor. I had a telemarketing-only case pending in Milwaukee, and I came in to represent the telemarketing class.
And how much of the fees are you supposed to get?
Your Honor, that has not even been touched yet.
Who decides that? The judge?
That hasn't been touched yet either.
Well, no, I'm asking you a question.
Okay, as a practical matter,
how does that work?
The way it works as a practical matter is that the judgment awarded fees to class counsel. Class counsel then allocate the fees to all the different lawyers who worked on the case based on their contribution.
Well, wait a second. If the information sharing class gets, $240,000? What did they get? $250,000?
Around there, approximately.
Okay. If they get that for a charity, they don't get it themselves, right? They get it for a charity, but that's okay. You mean to say they could get $250,000 and then their lawyers who fouled up the first time would get like $700,000 in attorney's fees?
Your Honor, all I suggested is that the lawyers involved at their discretion allocate the fees. This is usually
done. So it could end up with them, since they've been in it a longer time, you just came in at the last minute, so to speak. Maybe they'd say, oh, we should have $700,000. Right? Well, wouldn't that be a little bizarre?
They would not win on that argument, Your Honor.
Pardon?
They would not win on that argument.
Would
that would not happen. The As far as a couple other quick points, and then plaintiffs want to make an important point of their own. As far as Fleet selling information about who paid their bills, who was current on their mortgage, there is nothing in the factual record to support that statement. It was not part of any objection, not part of any declaration, nothing presented below, nothing presented in this court. That just popped out of
Well, what about the simple argument that if they were able to sell information, it must have been information that it might be in the public domain, but that it would be more costly to obtain otherwise?
That's why it had value, Your Honor. Right. That's why they sold it. That's what telemarketers do. They buy that information. The $300,000 that is going to California is not a benefit. Let me just clarify this right now. It is not a benefit to anybody in this case.
Right. It's just irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. Okay. In exchange for in the previous appeal, the court pointed out the importance of examining reversion provisions and how they may be negotiated, and the presence or absence of reversion to some degree may cause other things to change in the settlement. The reversion provision, previously there was no anti-reversion provision.
Right.
In this agreement, there is a very strong anti-reversion
provision. What has that made in terms of dollars? What the telemarketing class, forgetting the $300,000, what they will get under this agreement and what they got under the old one?
The telemarketing members of the class will get the direct payment to them will be the same as under the old agreement, but there's going to be an additional payment of in the neighborhood of, I think, $600,000 to $700,000 to Epic.
To the charity.
Right. It's not just a charity. This is the primary organization in the United States that advocates in courts privacy
the
rights.
The Epic, yeah.
And that's in addition to the...
So basically, is the difference between the old agreement and the new agreement that they get... The telemarketing people get $600,000 to $700,000. Someone
yes
gets $600,000 to $700,000 more than the previous. Is that basically
that's difference?
The bottom line.
Other
yeah.
differences are that money that was to be disgorged for selling information previously was going to
right.
pay.
To
claims,
those
and
now
that money is totally
to
in a separate
Epic.
Category yeah. that also right. is going to Epic
right.
on the grounds that it's
But that doesn't
to
affect
distribute.
the total amount of money. That's just who gets it.
Yes, it does, because it was one bucket being used to pay a different bucket, and now there are two buckets. So it does increase the total.
But increase the, or way to put it, the net cost to Fleet is increased by $600,000 to $700,000, is that... There.
No, I think it's increased by $600,000 to $700,000 on the
because that
by virtue
250
of the charity.
Was going to be deducted in effect from
plus the 250. It's increased.
So
by
it's more like
total.
A million. Let's say a million.
Right. That's approximately correct.
I understand the Massachusetts case is now dismissed, and the statute has been told by agreement, but. When we look at that Massachusetts Consumer Protection statute, you don't really need a showing there of actual damages, right? And so doesn't that create at least a potential settlement value for the information class?
Your Honor, this is the heart of what plaintiffs would like to address right now. The underlying focus of the objection is exactly what you said, that under Massachusetts law, mm-hmm. statutory damages are available without proof of actual damages, without proof of anything, upon a showing of an injury to a protected interest. They're automatic. This is the objector's position. Plaintiffs have continuously, in the district court and in this court, said, no, that is an incorrect reading of Massachusetts law. Loss causation is required. It just so happens that the objector's own counsel had a case in Massachusetts that was decided before the negotiations in this case in December of 2004, where they aired the view that you just expressed and that they have expressed, and they lost on that. The court said, no, I'm sorry, loss causation is required. Now, the main reason I'm standing here is I would like to point out that the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts last month, January 2006, issued a decision devoted entirely to this topic. They said loss causation is required, statutory damages are not automatic, loss causation has always been required. It was required in Aspinall, it was required in Laridy, it was required in all of our previous decisions. And they said, let me give you the name of the case. It's called Hirschenau.
Well, have you submitted
a letter? Your Honor, I have a visual aid that I would like to hand up if that's permissible.
Well, this case was decided when?
This case was decided in August of 2005.
August?
Yes.
So, well, the day of argument is a little late to push a case decided last August on it.
No, Your Honor.
You're supposed to submit a letter with a 28-J letter with an opinion and serve on counsel.
Well, Your Honor, we just discovered this. I regret this. The case came out in January. We just discovered it this week. And we would like to submit it.
I think said August.
No, I'm sorry.
Was it argued?
When you said this case, I thought you meant this case. Judge Lefko decided this case in August of 2005.
And you just and I see. There's nothing wrong with your bringing the case to our attention. I mean, that's fine. It's just that the other side, has to have a chance to respond.
Yeah, I agree. And Your Honor, I would submit that. I would like to, if I may, pass this visual aid out to the other counsel.
What is that?
It's simply the citation and a quote from it.
Submit that with the letter that Judge Posner was just talking about. Serve a copy in him.
I could very easily do that.
Right.
Would you suggest that?
And then they'd have a chance to digest.
It's surprising to me that any Massachusetts consumer protection lawyer would be unaware of this case.
Okay, well, we should hear from your co-counsel.
Okay, a quick final.
Because you're the telemarketing guy, right?
Right.
But now you're talking about the information.
Yeah, our interests in approving the settlement are aligned.
No, I understand, but doesn't he want to argue that?
We decided
but
that with only 7 minutes.
You run out of your time.
If I'm out of my time, then I'm out of my time.
Okay.
We decided it would not be efficient to split 7 minutes.
Oh, you didn't want to split it at all?
Not the 7 minutes.
So are you?
No, if you want to have the whole argument and not Mr. Sandler, that's fine.
No, I'm sorry. Mr. Sandler represents Fleet, and he does want his time.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. But he will. I see.
If it's his turn, it's his turn.
Okay.
Under Massachusetts law, which is what we've argued all the time,
we'll have to read that case.
There is no claim for $35 million. There's no claim for $105 million. There is no claim for any statutory damages.
Okay, we understand.
And the settlement is reasonable.
Okay, thank you.
Time.
Thank you. Mr. Sandler?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Sandler for Fleet Mortgage Company, one of the appellees here. When one of my colleagues was before this court a number of months ago, the first time around, the court had some concerns about the settlement as reflected in the Seventh Circuit decision, and I think those boiled down to concerns about the information sharing class. And specifically, the concern that the court below had failed to make a finding that it was appropriate that there be no direct economic payment to members of the information sharing class. That decision also suggested a couple of very specific concerns. I believe they were called warning signs with respect to the settlement. Specifically, that the disgorgement of the $243,000 in the information sharing class went to the telemarketing class, and that the counsel for the both classes were the same. An effort was made.
Wait a second. You've left out the important thing, and that is we said the judge has to value the claims. And now what the judge has done here, she has implicitly valued the claims at 20 cents a person. So what is the basis for thinking that that is actually the value of the of the information sharing, you know, cause of action.
Well, Judge, if I may, I'd like to reflect on, you know, Judge Lefkoe's decision. We think she laid all of that out. What she said in her decision was that there were no damages, and she talked about the state statutes and a number of states.
Well, what I don't understand is this is a nationwide class, but she only discussed four state laws, right?
She discussed them, I think, by way of example.
I don't understand. There are 50 states. It would take a lawyer, you know, like a day or 2 days to look up the, you know, consumer protection statutes in the 50 states and say X number of states require proof of injury and the others don't, right? And then you'd know exactly whether these people, I mean, you would know exactly. You would have a sense of, I mean, suppose 10 states with a fifth of the 100,400,000, which is like, you know, almost 300,000. Suppose 10 of those states, fifth of the states, don't require proof of injury but provide, you know, modest statutory damages, say $10. Well, that would be $5 million, right?
Well, that's correct under that hypothetical, but what has happened here, and remember, we have the plaintiff's lawyers in this case who agreed, having done their research, that there was very little value. You heard the Milberg Weiss, the Milberg firm out in California,
who agreed it had no value. The judge is not permitted to assume that the class action lawyers and the defendant have made an accurate, responsible estimation of damages because we know there's a conflict of interest. So I don't understand why the parties did not do a canvas of the 50 state consumer protection law. Maybe it would turn out, I don't know this new case, maybe it would turn out none of them permit, you know, statutory damages and there's no injury here. And then the value would be zero. That would be fine, but that hasn't been done.
I don't know why it hasn't been done.
Well, Your Honor, it's not a big job. These people want $750,000 in attorney's fees, but they don't even do, you know, 50 state research.
I think there were several different bases, that being one of them, on which Judge Lefkoe made the decision that
one of them. I haven't heard one of them.
Well, there is also the information.
Well, isn't also, because I didn't hear the first part.
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear number one.
Well, I think we had an objector in here as well who's putting all arguments appropriate, that they thought appropriate, before the court as well. And
an objector raises objection. If the objector says the judge did not value the potential recovery of the information class, it seems to me it behooves Fleet and the plaintiff's lawyers to do a little bit of research to see whether these people could recover any damages.
And we are unaware of any place.
It doesn't help to be unaware when you haven't looked. It's their statutes and cases, right? You just look, well, and you can say, yeah.
The question, though, is whether under the totality of circumstances, the district court judge, under an abuse of discretion standard, made an appropriate decision.
She did not value these claims.
But she also looked at the prospect of certifying a class on a nationwide basis. She also looked at the fact that all of the information was publicly available information, made a finding.
That's
there.
That's, of course, why it's important. I mean, there are two concerns. One is, I think Mr. Zavez is right. It's actually a very important point. The fact that information is in the public domain does not mean that it's public information, because it's sometimes extremely difficult to find and then to collate with, to combine with other information to have a meaningful invasion of you know, people's financial privacy. The fact that someone is willing to pay for this information suggests that even if it's in the, though it's in the public domain, it really isn't freely available. That's the first point. The second, the more important point is, maybe there are state statutes which, like federal statutes, simply award, you know, modest statutory damages without requiring any kind of proof of injury, and that's the whole purpose of statutory.
But that's only one of the issues. That's only one of the issues. Another issue is, was there a failure to disclose that the information would be shared? There's a whole, and what the district court judge did is went through the complete analysis and reached.
But since she didn't look at the statutes, what weight can she give to the failure to disclose or the not failure to disclose?
But what she did do is she looked at the statutes in the states where cases were brought.
No, she just looked at four statutes. Why didn't she look at 50? Not her personally. Why didn't the lawyers say, here, we've done a little study. There are 50 statutes, you know, protecting financial privacy. Not a single one of them would provide any relief for these people.
Well, I think what the plaintiff's lawyers did do is they said to the court, you know, we recognize that we have a very weak position here. The Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, in resolving the initial investigation, obtained no relief on information sharing because the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota came to the same conclusion. The Milberg Weiss firm in California obtained no relief, came to the same conclusion. Judge Norgel below came to that conclusion.
Where did that $300,000 come from?
The $300,000 was the telemarketing subclass.
That's a telemarketing.
Right. And
okay. Let me ask you just one more question,
sure,
since your time has expired. How much of the $750,000 in attorney's fees is going to the original plaintiff's lawyers, who are now the lawyers for the information class, if that's been determined and if you know?
To my knowledge, there's been no determination, and I do not know.
But is Mr. Zavez correct that the way this is resolved, it's by agreement among the lawyers rather than by a judicial determination?
Well, speaking for the defendant in the case, the settling defendant,
right,
we've agreed to pay plaintiff's counsel $750,000 subject to court approval, and however that works, we do not have a right or an intent to play a role in that decision-making.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And, pardon?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes, thank you.
Your Honor, this may be something Mr. Sandler was unaware of. The parties did go through the laws of all 50 states and the District of Columbia and Guam and the Virgin Islands, did prepare a chart, submitted it to the district court, and it's also part of the record in this court, the supplemental appendix at page 956. That shows that there are no states that allow statutory damages without a showing of actual damages in class actions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll look at that. Thanks. Mr. Zavez, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
You have three left.
Your Honor, I just want to address what he last said. Obviously, that appendix is wrong because Massachusetts does allow it.
Well, but not according to Mr. Cantor's.
Your Honor, when we made the argument that...
Well, was there anything in the district court submitted contrary to that document he cited to us that's in the appendix?
Well we demonstrated that Massachusetts knew we cover them. So, I mean, what you have here are plaintiffs who've already are stuck in a box of saying that there's no recovery, and they now can't change their position. So instead of trying to think of a way to get more money for the class, they're trying to justify what they actually obtained in the first settlement.
Did the district judge discuss the chart, mention the chart?
No, Your Honor. And I just wanted to speak for 1 second about the newly discovered Massachusetts case. In our brief that we submitted to this court, we relied on an older Supreme Judicial Court case called Liardi v. Brown to say that you do not, it has nothing to do with causation. It had to do with whether or not you had to prove damages or simply injury. Injury is a slightly fuzzier but lower standard. In any event, the case that Mr. Cantor referred to, And this is unusual for the Supreme Judicial Court, but there's a majority opinion, a concurrence, and a dissent. And part of what the swirl is whether or not this Hirschenau case overruled Liardi. The majority said, no, it didn't, and it did for a reason that actually fits exactly within the context of why our claims would be important. I think one of the things that's important here, as the court's trying to find a mechanism for getting everybody to play on a level field here, is that we believe that we have an extremely strong claim, perhaps even stronger than some of the initial underlying claims, for this unfair settlement practices. The fact that Fleet, in our view, misrepresented to District Court Judge Norville that they had to have an appeal bond because there was a concern that Fleet wouldn't be available to pay the money. Fleet, multi-billion dollar Fleet, wouldn't be available to pay this $2.4 million settlement. And that claim that a defendant used an obstacle, kind of deceptively created an obstacle in order to block people from exercising what otherwise they reasonably believe were their rights, is exactly the claim that Liardi v. Brown dealt with and said was a violation of 93A. And when you look at the Hirschenau case, and we'll respond to their letter, when you look at the Hirschenau case, that's exactly the distinction the court makes. The court says, when you have a private fight, you're going to have to show some actual kind of loss of some sort. But when it's enough in the public context, if a person is given a right and then you deceive them into believing they can't exercise that right, that is a 93A violation. That is causation of damages. And that is exactly what Hirschenau is about. So Hirschenau supports Liardi and supports our view not only of what's wrong with the initial actions of Fleet, but more importantly, and again, to the Seventh Circuit's concern about how do we police these things if we don't want to chase them ourselves, you have a bunch of lawyers now representing the objectors that are more than happy to pursue that claim and see whether there's any traction as a way to make people behave in this context when everybody's self-interest is contrary to the people they represent.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zepes, and thank you to Mr. Cantor and Mr. Sandler.